Welcome, people, and thank you for tuning in. This is the Sports Underground Podcast with Baron Graf.
And look who's coming up.
Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
So let's do what we do tonight.
And now, from the Hotbox Studio in Los Angeles, which is literally an 8x10 box in Baron's garage, here's your host, Baron Graf.
Hey, what is happening, folks? It's the Sports Underground. I'm your host, Baron Graf. Coming back at you. I know. Now you guys are like flipping out because you're like, what is going on? This is two shows and it's like not even, it hasn't been a month yet. What's going on? I'm doing another show. What's this rare treat? Two shows in 1 month? I know. Well, fortunately, and this, you never know. I'm not making any predictions. Although I am okay at that. I'm not making any predictions, but this could become a regular spot here. I'm back in the studio with my good friend, Ron Guerin. Ron, thanks for opening up your studio again to us.
Of course, Baron. It's absolutely my pleasure, as always.
So, good times to be had by all tonight. Definitely going to get into the Super Bowl. I'm not going to rub it in too bad.
Super Bowl?
I know, you've already forgotten.
There was a game?
I would be trying to black it out, too. We're also going to talk a little bit of NBA, a little bit of college basketball, though not much because I haven't been paying that much attention. Still football season, still doing football, and then baseball at the back of the show. Some very interesting comments from Mark Teixeira from the Yankees earlier this week. I don't know if anybody heard those, but we'll talk about that. But before anything, we have to talk about, I mean, this is the biggest, certainly the biggest North American sporting event. And probably with the exception of, like, the English Premier League, maybe the World Cup, this probably has to be one of the largest sporting events on Earth, I would think.
One of, if not the largest sporting event. Actually, I saw a recent news report. It was actually earlier this evening, and they were following Twitter activity during the Super Bowl. And when the power went out, they showed a graph of the entire world and how the Twitter activity increased when the power outage happened.
Wasn't that an interesting thing, that power outage? I mean,
it was amazing.
But
just quickly, all across the world, in every continent, Twitter exploded.
Sure.
Except in Russia or in Greenland, where they don't really care about the Super Bowl. Anyway.
Well, the more accurate statement is where they don't have television.
Maybe, yes.
I thought it was, I mean, in a lot of ways, I don't know. I reacted a little bit differently to the power outage at the Superdome. I think it kind of felt like a curse to me because it was like, look, okay, if the 49ers complete that miraculous comeback and win that game, there's always to me going to be a cloud hanging over that game because you have to question. I mean, certainly, at the time the power outage occurred, it looked like San Francisco had no answers on either side of the ball. It looked like Kaepernick was completely rattled. I did not think, at that point, I was thinking, you know, Dallas Cowboys, Buffalo Bills. I was thinking, this is the first Super Bowl blowout we're going to see for a while.
Yeah, and it was, of course, exactly against what you and I had thought, which was going to be a very closely contested game by two really prepared teams, and that definitely was not the case. The 49ers just did not show up in the first half. I mean, not one of their players looked even prepared or even conscious during the first half of that game.
Well, and it's funny because I heard a couple of interviews on Monday, and they were talking to players who were discussing their first time playing in the Super Bowl, and Drew Brees said he felt like he couldn't even get his feet on the ground. He felt like
they were just
for the
floating.
First couple of series, yeah. Like he can't even get his head in the game. And to me, that was part of what I was concerned about with the 49ers was, yeah, they're a very talented team, but I wasn't sure how they were going to handle those first few minutes. But let's also give credit where it's due because the Baltimore Ravens defensively came out with a very, very good scheme against the 49ers.
And I do believe that the first decision that was made in the game was a pivotal decision, and that was to give the ball to the San Francisco 49ers first right after the coin flip because it played to their strength. It played out exactly the way that they had hoped it would. They were able to stop the 49ers, give the ball to their offense early and score first.
Yeah, I think that's a veteran team relying, like you said, on the strength of their team. I also think it immediately puts the pressure on Colin Kaepernick. We talked a lot about the pressure and which quarterback was going to feel it. And I won't say I was surprised by that move. Certainly not as surprised as I was by some other decisions. But that, I thought, played definitely to their favor. As soon as I saw them go three and out, I thought, that's amazing. The other thing I keyed on right away is... And at first, I was watching it, and I was thinking, man, they really don't know what's happening right now. But what became remarkably apparent to me is that the Baltimore Ravens did to Colin Kaepernick essentially the exact same thing that the New England Patriots a decade earlier did to Marshall Faulk and the St. Louis Rams. They said, look, you have a very talented football team. We're going to let you beat us every possible way except with this guy. We are not going to let Colin Kaepernick's legs beat us in this game. And it's really fairly brilliant when you consider the fact that Frank Gore does not have home run speed. He's a great back. I love him. He will get you 4 to 8 yards almost every carry. And I've been a huge champion of Frank Gore ever since he came out of college at the U of Miami. But he does not have top-level elite speed.
Yeah, but go back to your earlier point, the fact that they're not going to let Colin Kaepernick beat them, absolutely. It was because the entire 49er team did not show up in the first half. In the second half, Colin Kaepernick was able to break down their defense a little bit, score with a running touchdown, and with the exception of calling up timeout at the wrong time, not running a running play, and of course throwing that really bad interception, which was just horribly overthrown, they were able to come back against that defense, and it wasn't because the defense wasn't playing well. It was because they were beating him.
Let me ask you this. How much, because prior to the power outage, San Francisco had
nothing.
Zero ability to move the ball significantly.
Nothing. They weren't there. They didn't wake up. I think God intervened and came down and woke up the 49ers for the second half.
I think that if you give any coaching staff, and certainly if you give a professional coaching staff on the level of the San Francisco 49ers, if you give that coaching staff, in essence, a second halftime,
yes,
they're going to figure a lot of stuff out.
And they were able to get their legs. They were able to really settle down. I think that they were just overloaded with adrenaline and struck, awestruck by the situation across the board, not just the young guys on the team, but across the board. That team did not show up until after the power outage, and they could really settle down and start playing football again. It was like a whole nother day.
And it was really weird, too, because if you think about that moment, that was a pretty key moment because it plays absolutely to the strength or to the benefit of San Francisco. And like you said, their young guys can kind of slow down a little bit. But it also plays completely against the strength of Baltimore. Like, you do not want those veteran defenders. You don't want Ray Lewis sitting around getting cold. You don't want Ed Reed getting cold.
No, they sat for 30 minutes, and it would take them another 30 minutes to warm up,
and
you would think.
And it showed, because I felt that they played progressively better defensively the deeper into the ball game that it got. And so for me,
they definitely stiffened at the goal line there at the end of the game.
And of course, I mean, I was saying to anybody that would listen during the game at the party I was at, I was like, nobody, first of all, you don't see stuff like this in the movies. You can't find this in a play. You can't find this in reality television.
You can't write this because nobody would believe it.
That's exactly right, because who would believe that Ray Lewis, arguably the best man to ever play middle linebacker in the league's history, who would believe that it all came down to one final goal line stand to put a bookend on his career? I mean, you could not write that ending. That to me, as that was developing, I was just like, this is amazing. I even said, like, pay attention. This is the last 4 minutes of football you're ever going to watch Ray Lewis play.
Yeah, and of course, you know, being on the side of the 49ers, I was writing a completely different script in my mind, wishing that they had run some more effective play calls there at the end. I envisioned Colin Kaepernick running it in for that final scoring touchdown, sort of as I predicted last week that would happen. But it was just a series of bad play calls, and it could have gone either way. If Kaepernick had decided to put it down and run, or if they made a better play call there and had run the pistol, the option play again, and allowed Colin Kaepernick to have more of the ability to run that ball in there on one of those four calls, I think it would have been a different outcome. And we can, you know, throw away all of the referee calls and all of that stuff. I mean, that is all out in the wash. It could have been an offsides. It could have been a holding, whatever. But Colin Kaepernick should have, in one of those plays, ran the option and attempted to score on his own, because I think that he would have been able to make some of those guys miss, and it would have been a completely different script. That's why the end of that game was extremely exciting, and the Super Bowl paid off in the end.
Absolutely, because, I mean, look, if, like you said, if they had done any number of things with the play calls, and by the way, I always have to do this, but I applaud you for being a fan first, but also having some clarity on this. I can't tell you how many people I have heard complaining about that no call in the end zone at the end of the game, which is completely ridiculous. If anybody wants to get into that with me, I will have all kinds of Twitter and Facebook wars with you over that. I've got a visual diagram that I'm going to post on the Facebook page. If you guys want to see that, it's broken down frame by frame of exactly why it wasn't a penalty. Whole other side issue there. I thought, especially considering that Haloti Ngata was out of the game. He had been injured a couple of series before. Especially considering that, I can't believe that in that circumstance, the only running play they ran was Michael James in between the tackles.
Right.
I mean, first of all, that's not the guy to run between the tackles. It's Frank Gore if you're going to go between the tackles.
Absolutely.
With that guy.
Absolutely. And I would line up to run it in between the tackles and then run the option, have Colin pull it out and run out around the edge and try to do something like that. But apparently, Colin Kaepernick was interviewed today, and he said actually one of those other play calls of those four was a running play, and he audibled out of it, and that was the one where he rolled out to the right and had no options because they were playing the run, and he audibled out of it.
And so to Baltimore's credit, you have to say that they effectively took away his ability to hurt them with his legs.
Absolutely. And they took away the run, and they took away his option, because when he rolled out to the right, there was four or five guys right in front of the goal line or right behind it that were ready to shut him down if, in fact, he made the attempt to get into the end zone.
And I have to say this. I mean, to me, it felt like in that moment, the 49ers coaching staff let them down. If you watch, especially that last pass play where everybody wants to cry about it, it's like, but if you watch it, that's essentially on the 5-yard line, and they have four wide receivers in the pattern. It's essentially four wide receivers on go routes.
Yeah.
On the goal line, you cannot run that.
It was a poorly designed play for that area of the field, and it was a poorly called play for the situation. And unfortunately, that's got to go on Jim Harbaugh's shoulders. It was just a bad series of play calls. And, you know, as long as I just said Jim Harbaugh, unfortunately, the man is a poor loser. And I know that he is my coach, but the man is a crybaby, and I hope you hear this, Jim. Stop complaining about the refs, okay? We lost the game. That's just what happened. It was a bad series of play calls and decisions by our quarterback there at the end.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to me that, again, it's almost like a tale of two cities, literally, because you see, I mean, I just don't think that you could have possibly handled that moment with more dignity and class and grace than John Harbaugh did. I don't know if you saw the post game when they were talking to him, and he basically said that, you know, his brother was the best coach in the league.
Classy man. All across the board, he handled himself with a decorum and class doesn't really cover it. He handled it like a true professional, like a man, like a guy who had full respect for his family, for the franchise, for the game of professional football, just
Wait
across
a second.
The board.
Hold on, I gotta stop on this one, though. Hold on, do you remember during the power outage when they walked up and told him they couldn't start the game?
Well, yeah. Well, I didn't think that he thought that he was on camera at that moment. Maybe that was the one little momentary lapse of reason that he had. But overall, I give him an A+ on the way that he behaved during the game.
So here's my question: do you think? Let's just say hypothetically. Let's say the tables are turned. And let's say Kaepernick gets away and he scores a touchdown there and the Ravens aren't able to come back and the 49ers win this game. I could very easily see this thing going completely the opposite way. Like, I could definitely see John Harbaugh on the other side of the field in a very similar circumstance where they get a bad play call in his mind. Or a bad penalty call. I could easily see him.
Well, it's fun to speculate now that we're on the other side of it, and I would love to see that someday, and I wish we had seen it yesterday. And but I think that history has shown that he is a little bit more reserved and has a little more self-control than his brother does. They both lose it sometimes, but I think that... That Jim Harbaugh is kind of a whiny little kid sometimes, and he needs to really figure out a way to behave a little bit more like a professional on that football field, because I don't think he's representing the team well. I don't think he's representing his family well. And this guy's my coach. I think he's fantastic. I think he's one of the best coaches we've had. I think he's the best coach since Bill Walsh / Seifert days. But he needs to handle himself better on the field.
Well, and I think that the amazing thing about this moment for the San Francisco team is, let's just say it out loud. I mean, this is a very young team. It's a very talented team. I don't think this is by a far stretch of the imagination the last time we're going to see them in this moment. And I think ultimately, when the dust has settled, when the emotion has come back a little bit, I think ultimately Jim Harbaugh is going to see himself in that moment and think, geez, you know, I didn't really handle myself the best.
I would hope so. I would hope he would take this as a learning experience and really look at what happened during that game and think about how he handles himself in the future. And yes, the 49ers are a young team. And I expect nothing but really good things for them next season and for the next few years. But at the same time, I have to be a realist about this. I mean, 49er fans out there that might be listening, you know, Vegas is calling it a 5-1 shot that they're going to get back to the Super Bowl. They're calling the Ravens a 10-1 shot. And if you really look back, nobody's come back and won the Super Bowl after having been there and lost it since the 70s. And only a couple of guys have done it, including John Elway, and it was at the end of his career. So the odds are very much against either one of these teams making it back. I mean, everybody was picking the Packers to go back. That didn't happen. And with a quarterback like Colin Kaepernick who runs around, as we've seen with RG3 and others, those guys get hurt. You never know what's going to happen. Alex Smith's not going to be there to back him up next year, probably. So they're going to have some other guy.
You can go ahead and say definitely on that.
Yeah, he's not going to be there. So, and you know, they're going to get some draft picks. They're going to have to bring another quarterback in, and it's going to be the first time that Colin Kaepernick is going to be, without a doubt, the starting quarterback from the beginning of the season. It's going to be a whole new responsibility for him. And who knows what can happen? One of a billion things can happen to the 49ers next year, and the odds are against them getting back, although they do look like a great team.
Yeah, and I think it's a little... I always laugh about the Monday morning or immediately after any championship...
Any game.
Whether it be baseball or basketball, it seems like invariably they go to
these... That's right. We still have the San Francisco Giants. Sorry, I just wanted to say that to my St. Louis fan. Anyway, go on.
And you know what's funny is they always go to these network talking heads, and invariably when they run out of stuff to talk about, invariably they come down to... Well, can this team repeat?
It's like in the NFL, that's such a long shot. It's ridiculous.
In every sport, it's a long shot, and especially in the NFL, that's so grueling. But let's not even like bring up the fact that like the draft happens, free agency happens, and now you're also talking about a situation where that was Colin Kaepernick's 10th start in the NFL, and the NFL, I think, more than any other professional sport, is one where you can be great for one season and be completely solvable for the rest of your career. You can ask Michael Vick about this. You can ask the authors of the Wildcat offense about this. You can ask Tim Tebow about
this. Ask Dan Marino.
Dan Marino is a good example of this. And I almost have to wonder, now that we've got a lot of game film on the pistol offense, I almost have to wonder how effective it's going to be going forward. Now, I will say this. I think that Colin Kaepernick can beat you in more than one way. And I think that ultimately next year might be rough for him. But I think ultimately he has a shot at coming through this and being a very good quarterback.
Well, I 100% agree. And, you know, it's such a copycat league. A lot of people are going to be looking at this season and the fact that Joe Flacco won the MVP in the Super Bowl as a stand back, drop back quarterback who can throw the long ball and pick you apart that way. I think a lot of people in the NFL will look at that and say, this is the prototype. We need a Peyton Manning. We need a Tom Brady. We need a now Joe Flacco to stand back there and pick you apart, a big, strong quarterback who can throw the ball. And Kaepernick has that ability. So next year, if they put him in a position where he can use his arm more and use that running ability as a fallback sort of defensive move, when the things break down and he can go and protect himself and gain 7 yards to pick up a first down and run out of bounds and not get hurt, that will work. I believe that that's the case. They're not going to make him run the ball like Michael Vick or RG3. I sincerely hope they protect him next year.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think you're going to see a lot of... The funny thing is we talk about it and we say, like, I think they were talking to Brian Billick about it in the postgame show, and they're saying, oh, they were talking about Colin Kaepernick. And Brian Billick is like, it's funny that people talk about this like you can just go out and find one of these guys.
Yeah, they don't grow professional quarterbacks on trees.
Let's just go find the next Joe Flacco. Let's just go find Colin Kaepernick. It just doesn't happen. And I think ultimately you're right. I think what we're going to see next year is we're going to see a decided split in people's approach and teams' approach. I think there's going to be certainly a faction of the NFL that goes the direction of, let's run this pistol. Let's run a little bit more of a college-style offense where we've got the run first, or at least the read option available in the package. And then you're going to see the other people that are like, no, because that didn't actually win. We're going to stick with drop back, huck it down the field.
The proven formula for many, many years now has been the drop back traditional quarterback that can go and win a Super Bowl with his arm and with his decision-making. So that's been proven over a long period of time. Not many running-style quarterbacks, besides Steve Young, has really gone through and won the Super Bowl and done it for a long period of time.
And, I mean, let's talk about the truth, because even Steve Young was not running as a design.
No, not at all. He was using it in this defensive way. If the play broke down, he had the ability to go and gain a first down if need be and make some guys miss and make a play if the play broke down. Now, that's what they're going to have to, I think, move towards with Colin Kaepernick next season.
I completely agree, and I think a lot of what will determine, let's just say it right now, Baltimore's going to have a rough couple of years.
No question about it. They're going to dismantle. These guys are old, and they're going to lose their emotional leader.
Baltimore has never, with the exception of the games he's been injured for, Baltimore has never gone into a football game without Ray Lewis on the sideline, on the field, in the locker room.
For how long now?
Their entire franchise.
Yeah, okay.
Their entire existence.
Exactly.
He and Jonathan Ogden were the first draft picks of the franchise. So this is a team, even if they keep Ed Reed, which I really think that they should do, even if they keep Ed Reed, this is a team that is going to go through a growing phase. And I think Flacco deserves to get paid. I've always thought that Joe Flacco took too much heat for stuff that he couldn't control. I think that offense looks very dynamic. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens to them offensively. But again, like every other sport, it's like what makes a champion a champion? You know, and when your entire identity is going to change, and it will for Baltimore, that's going to be tough. I would actually agree with Vegas in the sense that I think that San Francisco has a better chance at getting back to the Super Bowl than Baltimore does.
I agree, 100%. I mean, their heart, soul, their personality just retired.
Exactly. And it's funny because you look at the dichotomy between sports. And now that, you know, football is behind us, we're kind of moving now into the basketball season. And the interesting thing about the NFL is that, to me, it is more difficult to repeat in the NFL today than any other sport, especially the NBA. I think we could, and we'll have a conversation after the break here, we'll have a conversation about this, but I think we could very easily end up seeing the same two teams in the finals this year as we did last year in the NBA. More after the break.
We're not so high, can't feel the truth. Too many haters in the air, I don't feel the love. Look, R.I.P., yeah. R.I.P., yeah. R.I.P., yeah. R.I.P., yeah. R.I.P., R.I.P., we just killed the club. Yeah, R.I.P., 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 R.I.P.,
Yeah, unless
college basketball purist.
Absolutely, unless you're a Hoosier and you're watching every single game, or you're a bleeding Ohio State basketball fan, then yeah, or
like, a Dookie,
yeah, or my good friend JD, who's he just bleeds UCLA. I mean, everything about his dog's names are UC and LA.
That's psychopath.
Yes, I know.
JD, get some help.
JD, yeah, I hope you hear this.
That is not okay. you definitely need to talk to somebody about that. I thought you were going to say, like, his dog's names are, like, Reggie and Miller.
No.
Okay,
it's
that's
UC
kinda cool.
And LA. And he's an alum, and he definitely just bleeds the blue and gold. And so if you're that guy, sure. The basketball season may be relevant, but until the tournament starts, I'm not really even paying attention.
And look, even if you're a sports guy like I am, you know, okay, maybe I'll be interested in, you know, middle February, late February, going into the tournament. Maybe I'm going to pay a little bit of attention to the conference tournaments, but I'll tell you, more than anything, what has killed college basketball for me.
Tell me, Baron.
It's the whole realignment thing that happened. Because the Big East is no longer the Big East. I mean, I remember the Big East when the Big East meant something in basketball. I mean, nobody, you could not care less about their football teams. But when it was basketball season, there was no other conference to talk about besides those, I mean, just those heavyweight fights. And it's a combination of factors, I think, that has really, really killed college basketball's regular season is, one, conference realignment in the name of chasing football dollars, which has been absolutely criminal what they've done to a couple of these basketball conferences.
There's no question about it. The fact that it's motivated not on competition, not on really making the teams that deserve it have an opportunity, the ones that are in these low market schools, it's all about the dollar that comes from television. And unfortunately, that has sort of watered down and made irrelevant what's going on.
Yeah, and the other contributing factor that this has all happened together, and I think someday in the future we're going to look back on this and go, wow, that was a perfect storm, and I wish somebody had had some vision. But the issue of the one-and-done college basketball athlete, you got to remember, in the 80s, in the 90s, the reason we were able to see these heavyweight fights.
Teams were together for 4 years.
Those guys would play 3 and 4 years together. I mean, I remember when it was an anomaly that Michigan started the five. You remember the Fab Five freshmen?
Of course.
And that was such an anomaly that they were starting five freshmen. Now, I don't think that you could name a team in the country that's not starting, if not featuring, at least one freshman. Yeah. At least.
Well, they're lucky to have talented freshmen nowadays. I mean, a lot of them who have size, strength, and can play at that high a level are already being looked at by professionals, by the pro teams. So I think that they're just happy to have those talented freshmen. And if they don't play them, they're going to walk.
Yeah, they're either going to go play someplace else, or they're going to go play in Europe. A lot of guys have been doing that.
Yeah. Just to go get paid.
And the unfortunate thing is that what suffers is the game of college basketball. And it's such a weird dichotomy. I can't blame the player. I cannot blame the 18-year-old kid, the 17-year-old kid that is literally NBA ready. I can't blame that kid for not really wanting to play 1 year in college under the current system. It's weird because when you think about the money that is generated for these schools, to me, it's a little bit criminal.
It's a lot criminal. And you mentioned the Fab Five. Those guys made a statement back then about the amount of money that Michigan was making off of them and the fact that they weren't making any of it. And I don't know, they had...
There was some scandal around that.
There was some scandal, and they came out with, you know, blank T-shirts, and they wore black socks, and they took the logos off of their shirts just to make a statement about how much money these guys are making off of us, and we're not seeing a dime. So I think it started even back then. And the fact that, I mean, you mentioned going to Europe. In other countries, the culture is built around making professional athletes from a very young age. And guys in Italy, in Spain, and many other countries start at a very young age and start playing professionally at 15, 16, 17 years old and don't go to college because it's designed around making a career from a very young age. That's in many, many cultures, including Olympic athletes where they're state-sponsored and that type of thing. So you cannot blame the player for wanting to go out and earn a living while he can.
Yeah, and especially in sports like basketball and football where you're one bad knee injury away.
Absolutely.
I mean... The crazy thing is that if it's going to change, it's going to have to come from football. Because nobody, no coach, no conference, no athletic director, no single school or conference has enough pull to push this past the NCAA in basketball. The only way this is going to happen, the only way we're going to even approach the idea of paying student athletes in any way, shape, or form is if it's led by football. And the interesting thing is, in the winter meetings of the SEC and the coaches' meetings, that was one of the things that they discussed. It's like, hey, is there a way we can figure out a way to help these guys out? And listen, I've had a couple of conversations with my sister, who's now been accepted into grad school. Congratulations, Amber, by the way. That's awesome. And she's talking about, you know, the different programs that are out there. You know, there's possibility for things like fellowship and stuff like that, where they can get some money to support themselves while they do this. And I'm not saying that these guys have to be paid like professional athletes in college, but for God's sake, I mean, goodness, I watched, I finally got around to watching the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary about the Miami Hurricanes. And they were asking them about taking money, which was pretty commonly known in that era, in that area of the country. And these guys were saying, look, you gave us $30 to eat all weekend. Like, look at me. I'm 300 pounds. $30 won't feed me for a day.
Right.
You know? And so what we're asking of these guys is a little bit ridiculous.
It's a lot ridiculous. Most students who are not involved in athletic programs work another job. They have to. They can't afford to go to college without it. I mean, people who don't have scholarships or don't have very wealthy parents, or their student loans don't go as far as they could. I mean, paying for, you know, books and housing and everything that goes along with going to school, they still have to feed themselves. They still have to have some life outside of work and school. And college athletes don't have any time to go out and work and earn extra money, and they should, and because of the amount of money that these schools are making, they should compensate them or at least give them some sort of way to live while they're playing.
Something. I mean, make it like scholarships, where it's like, okay, you can give one guy, you know, whatever, $2,000 a year, and another guy you can give $1,000 a year, and then you can give six guys $500, whatever it is. You got to do something for these guys. And I think that if you introduced this element to college basketball, would it keep your Kyrie Irvings in college? Would it keep these guys? No, it won't keep the highest tier of guy in college. But it will keep that next step down. That guy who could declare after his freshman year, maybe go somewhere in the third or fourth round, play his way into the league a little bit. It's going to keep guys like that, I think, would have a better chance of keeping guys like that in the collegiate ranks where they belong. I mean, I think you can make an argument for many, many players. The most pertinent to me, because I watched it happen. I said it when it did happen, and I believe we've seen it come to fruition. When Kevin Love left UCLA, I said he's leaving too early, because there's no doubt he had the physical gift. He had gotten pushed around, if you remember, in the national championship game. He got pushed around by Dorsey when they played Memphis. So it was clear that he had the physical gifts offensively, but he hadn't quite hardened defensively enough. And if you think about it, UCLA's got Ben Howland. He's one of the best defensive coaches in the era. Think about Kevin Love's first few years in the NBA. Kind of got pushed around. Kind of couldn't find his place on the floor defensively. And then he matured and he grew into it. Now, I'm not saying you're going to keep Kevin Love for 4 years. I'm not even saying you're going to keep him for three, but maybe you keep him for two, and maybe you keep him for three. And suddenly those UCLA teams, you're talking about UCLA, that could have turned into a dynasty if they're able to keep Kevin Love. Just as an example. But let's go, just to kind of shift gears here at the back of the show, let's kind of shift gears and go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, because I saw something very interesting earlier this week. Mark Teixeira in baseball made this statement. I don't know if you read this article, but he made this statement that, you know, he's approaching the back end of this huge contract that the Yankees gave him. And he basically came out and said that he's going to have a very difficult time living up to the money that they're paying him, and spoke about it, to his credit, I think, spoke about it in a very matter-of-fact and frank way. Like, look, When I was 20, I could go out and hit 30 home runs and 100 RBIs and not think twice. And what it takes physically for me to do that now, even at 30, I think 32 is how old he is, which is, ancient, right?
Yeah. Well, I wonder what his peers are saying. I'm sure that he's not the most popular guy in the clubhouse right now or across Major League Baseball coming out and saying something like that.
Well, he's probably, I mean, in New York, they probably don't care because those guys are all getting paid millions of dollars. But yeah, it's very interesting. And it's one of those things where usually in the fraternity of baseball, you never hear stuff like that.
I would say trade him. Trade him right now. Get him off my roster. I don't want that guy making himself seem, I mean, seeing that he's not going to be good enough to earn the money that, just pretend, don't even say that. In my opinion, that gives opponents an edge. They're going to not see him as much of a threat anymore. And the people around him within the league are not going to respect him for saying that. So, I mean, maybe it is a credit to him to say, yeah, we get paid a lot of money, maybe I don't deserve it. But on a competition level, A, I think that guys are going to resent him for saying that and they're going to go after him. And he just professed his weakness. So guys are going to be trying to strike him out even more. They're going to be throwing him inside a little bit more. They're going to want to make him look foolish so that they prove what he said is true, that you don't deserve to be here and you don't deserve the money. Let's see if you can hit this.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's one of those things where you can look at it that way for sure. If that's the approach you want to take, I guess my contention on that would be I don't think anybody tries harder or less hard at any given time once they step onto a Major League Baseball field. I think you're only afforded so many opportunities, especially as a pitcher, to go out there. I can't imagine anybody taking anything off or, I mean, sure you're going to pitch guys a little bit differently based on how much they've hurt you in the past, but I don't see it. I guess I don't see it necessarily as much of a competitive advantage. I definitely can see the case for some resentment around the league. Maybe not even in his own locker room, but sure. I mean, if I'm a guy coming up and I'm raking, and I mean, if I'm, you know, Jose Bautista, for example, and my team just went out and signed up a whole bunch of guys out of nowhere, you know, I'm thinking, hey, my money's coming soon. And now this guy's going to come out and say this. Sure, okay, I can see that, a case for resentment around the league. But I don't know. I mean, call me sentimental. Call me, you know, an old school guy. But in the shadow of the passing of one of the greatest baseball players ever to live, Stan Musial, it seems to me like there's not enough guys like this in the league. And people don't know this. This is not commonly known. But Stan Musial, 1 year after, and this was towards the end of his career, he had what for him was a subpar season. Very good season nonetheless, but a subpar season based on where he had been. And he went to Augie Bush, who owned the team at the time, and he asked for a pay cut. This is before the days of free agency, mind you, but he asked for a pay cut because he said he didn't earn the money that they were going to pay him and that he would play better next year. And if he played better next year, then they could pay him what they had originally agreed upon.
Sucker.
Now, you can call it that if you want, but I think I kid. I think that is something that rang true with people of that area of the country at the time. And I feel like in an era where we too often see guys playing out contracts where they're dramatically overpaid. I mean, look, in that same locker room, the Yankees are desperately trying to get out from under Alex Rodriguez's contract.
His second $250 million contract.
Yeah, they're desperately trying to get out of that contract. And so I think that, and I would argue too, has vastly underperformed for the amount of money he's been
no
paid.
Question.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where I think that players in Major League Baseball and all professional sports, if they pay attention, I think that they will be surprised at how the public responds to what Mark Teixeira has said. I think that if anybody's paying attention, they're going to realize, hey, we're only here because they watch. And I think it could surprise some people. Now, I don't know if it changes anything, but I think it's going to be interesting to watch how America reacts to this.
We'll just have to wait and see. Hey, before we go, I'm going to put you on the spot here. This is episode 38 of season 2, correct? So who is your favorite number 38?
Favorite number 38. This is tough. You are putting me on the spot because, as you know, I am a deep sports nerd, but I am not nerdy enough to know all numbers of all time.
Oh, you don't have the 38, do you?
Hang on, I'll get it. I'll get it, but I just didn't have it off the top of my head. If you'd asked me anything under 38, I got, oh yeah, Curt Schilling.
Curt Schilling, there you go, ladies and gentlemen.
And by the way, is the only number 30. Who wears 38?
Yeah, exactly. That's, I couldn't think of one, so I was hoping that you could come up with one.
What kind of number is 38, Curt? Curt Schilling.
Schilling.
But seriously, 207 lifetime wins, over 3,000 strikeouts, World Series MVP.
Not too bad.
Pitched on a bloody sock that might have been doctored.
Is that in the Smithsonian, or is that in just the,
I think
the Hall of
Fame? I think it is in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
It is, yeah,
I think it is, yeah, which is hilarious. But whatever. That's it. That's the show. I hope you guys enjoyed tuning in, and maybe, I'm not going to speak for him, I won't put words in the man's mouth, but maybe if this works, we're going to do this a little bit more moving forward. I hope you guys have a great week. Whatever you do, wherever you do it, do me one thing. Keep right.
You have been listening to the Sports Underground Podcast, and you know we always welcome your take. You can find the Sports Underground on Facebook, so go ahead and like it. If you want to download, hit us up on iTunes. And remember, come back again next time and get some.